Right now, though, we're joined by our tech correspondent, Mark Pesce. Kia ora, Mark.
Good morning.
We've talked a little this morning about the government's new COVID app, and this is something that you want to look at, these track and trace apps all over the world popping up. What are your views on them?
So what we're seeing is a whole bunch of different approaches. New Zealand's approach is, I think, very charmingly homespun in that it relies on people to basically do a lot of the tracking and tracing. Many of the other apps use Bluetooth so that the phones are basically calling out to one another when they're in proximity, because Bluetooth only works out to a few meters. And so it tells when you're within a few meters of someone else's smartphone, and it can tell if you've been there for a certain number of minutes, and then it can basically do an exchange of information if it feels like you've been there long enough that maybe one of you could have contracted a disease that the other had. So there are different techniques for this. Now, overnight, Apple and Google released new operating system features that make it easier for people to write these apps, but you have to do it within their very stringent security rules. And it's not clear that those security rules were designed with public health in mind. They were certainly designed to present user safety and security front of mind, which is good if you're a user, but maybe less useful if you're trying to track an outbreak. And you see that there's quite a tug of war going on between these tech giants, these trillion-dollar tech giants, and these relatively more modest public health agencies, both in states and in nations, trying to sort of wrestle their way into how we can use these different technologies. New Zealand's taken a completely different path. It was basically like, yeah, we're going to actually allow you to keep that diary that Jacinda Ardern said she wanted you to keep, but we're going to help you with an app for that that will track where you are and when you go there so that you will be able to track and trace where you've been if you need to remember. So there are different approaches here. It's not clear any of these approaches are a winner. It's also not clear that relying heavily on Bluetooth technology to sort of do all the paperwork is the right solution. They've been doing that for a little while in Iceland, and the public health authorities are like, well, it's kind of useful, maybe not hugely useful. So we have to be careful about putting too many eggs in one basket here. We have to rely on good public health, good tracking and tracing, which is a very human task, and good human memory. If the tools help with that, great. But it's not clear yet that they do.
And to succeed, particularly the New Zealand version, relies on people who've been incredibly responsible over the last few weeks, as you say. The onus is on them to download it, and I haven't yet, but I will, and be responsible. Do you feel that's a good way to go? It's also about protecting privacy, which I think is another issue, isn't it, for people?
I think it's a good way to go in the sense that it builds a habitual behavior of remembering where you've been and, sense logging into that space, because then it helps us all to stay aware of how in the world we are, how many potential contacts we have. So if people can build that as a habit of going somewhere, scanning the QR code, keeping that app available, if we can build that up, then people start to build up their own sense of, oh, I've been a lot of places, or I haven't been many places, and that may help. So as a discipline, keeping that diary is a good thing, rather than really just relying on the device to do it. Because particularly in Australia, there was a belief when the app was first released that if you had the app, it would tell you if someone near you was infected, which it absolutely does not do. And so people were acting perhaps more recklessly because they felt they were protected app. Whereas doing something that's more like a diary reminds you that you actually need to take care of your own behavior.
It depends also, of course, on businesses downloading the QR code. We just had a text. I'm not sure if you can help this listener, Mark, but it says, why do you need a Realme login to get a QR code for your business? I think there are still questions, and businesses are still a little bamboozled by what's going on. But that has to be crystal clear for them as well as for the public, surely.
It does, and I suspect that one of the reasons why is because it's a security measure to prevent fake QR codes from popping up, and so preventing the database from being hijacked in that way. So they're going to be quite restrictive, I think, on where they put those business QR codes out. I think that we are all in a process of learning about how to do this right, and remembering that this is the first day that the app has been released, there are going to be bumpy bits here. We are all basically beta testing software that we all have to learn how to use in a hurry because it's important. But even the designers haven't had a chance to work out all of the rough edges.
If you were working on this project, Mark, here's a curly one for you. What would be the next issue that you would bring in, or the next capability that you would bring into the New Zealand model? As we say, it is very basic in early days, but what do you think would be the next most important thing? Would it be GPS?
You know, the so they're using GPS in Iceland right now. They're using GPS in Taiwan right now, and it's somewhat useful. But you have to have a lot of buy-in from the public that their location is going to be tracked everywhere. And people always go, well, Google knows where you are. Yeah, but Google's using it for commercial purposes. The government's got a kind of different intent behind it. And so if you're going to go with something like GPS, which might be more useful, but again, that's an open question. If you're going to do that, you really need to have a lot of buy-in from people. I think maybe the next place to go is to have the app have some sort of friendly reminder or coaching you into using it. This is what's called onboarding when you're using an app, something that guides you into using it well. And we need to see usage patterns. We need to see how people are using the app first in order to understand how to guide them into using it better.
I guess the test will be, and we all hope this doesn't happen, that there is some kind of outbreak or cluster somewhere. And that's when it will be put to the test, isn't it?
Yes, but I think what we'll see at that point is there's a lot of tracking and tracing that will be done just by human beings on the ground, asking people lots of questions, and it will facilitate some of that. It will facilitate some clarity, but it's not going to be the complete solution. It just helps.
Your next story is about Tim Bray. I hadn't seen this phrase before, rage quitting Amazon. So tell us what's happened here and why it's significant.
So Tim Bray is a bit of a legend in technology circles. There's a format called XML, and pretty much every document that you see that's electronic these days is in that format. It's sort of the grandfather format for almost all web documents now. And he was the pioneer of this back 20 years ago. And about 5 years ago, he was brought into Amazon Web Services, which is the part of the Amazon empire where, for instance, New Zealand is storing the COVID app data, as is Australia. It's a vast infrastructure that powers companies all around the world to work in the cloud. So it's the cloud computing company. And it's doing very well. Its employees are very well paid. But Tim became increasingly aware that, in fact, Amazon is doing everything in its power to stop its employees who are doing all the package packing, who are basically poorly paid, who are dying of COVID in America now because they're working in warehouses which aren't properly sanitized. These people are trying to organize, and Amazon is basically firing these people or really calling down the law on them and so on and so forth. And Tim saw this, and he tried to take this internally to get Amazon to change his practices. He's a vice president. He was able to take it all the way up the chain. And he was basically told, no, sorry, our practices are not going to change. And so he himself basically did the only thing that he felt he could do ethically at that point, which was to quit this incredibly powerful, incredibly lucrative job at an incredibly big company. And he did this the end of April and wrote a very clear essay about why he came to this decision, why he took it internally, and didn't make a stink about it until after he had left. And then after he had left, he laid out his reasons why. And it's really, this is something that we don't see. We see people working at companies that are more or less unethical enterprises, and we never see them becoming so overwhelmed by the unethical nature of the business that they're in that they just quit. This is a very quiet thing, and it very rarely happens in technology. And I think what Tim is doing is setting an ethical bar for us, that if actually do try to fix the problems in your company and you can't do it, your ethical option is to quit and to tell people why.
Can I ask, has it made any difference to the conditions of those he was concerned about?
Yeah, probably not immediately. I mean, there is a lot of talk now about Amazon being subject to a bunch of labor practice legislation and antitrust legislation. So I think it's drawn some more attention to it, particularly in the circles of high technology. So the people who are paid a lot of money and have quite influential roles, it's more that. It's more shining a light on that level of complicity. And he's basically saying, look, we shouldn't be complicit in those kinds of labor practices. We are worth more than this, and we should be acting differently.
Will this do any damage to Amazon, or are people more likely, because they like a bargain, to go, that's terrible, and then place their next order?
I have to admit, I did buy a new monitor on Amazon this month in lockdown because I had to do something with my office. And I did that after I read the Tim Bray piece. So I wonder if you're right about that. But it may mean that people who go to work for Amazon will have to make a decision about whether they're going to be complicit with the labor practices that Amazon is doing. I think it's more aimed at those folks. And Amazon is in the global battle for talent, along with Google and Facebook and Apple and Netflix. And that's where it probably has some weight.
Do you think Tim Bray will pop up somewhere else? I mean, presumably he doesn't have to financially, but given he is, as you say, such a legend, such a giant in technology circles, have we heard the last of him?
I doubt it. I mean, he's consistently been at the forefront of computing for 20, 25 years now. So I suspect he will be in, and if he hasn't already been recruited into another great firm, I suspect he's entertaining offers now.
Very good. Your next story, TSMC in Arizona. What is this?
This is the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation. Now, most people will never have heard of it. Almost every smartphone in the world has chips from TSMC in it, particularly if you own an iPhone, a newer iPhone. That CPU in the iPhone is manufactured at TSMC because TSMC in the last 10 years have become the best manufacturers of chips in the world. They are, we define chips by generations, by how small you can make them. TSMC is two generations ahead of the other best chip makers in the world, which are Samsung and Intel. Everyone knows Intel because it's inside your PC. Two generations ahead. Huge facilities in Taiwan, but they've agreed to build a facility in the United States in Arizona. And this is because there's a strong geopolitical angle here, because essentially if you have the best chip maker in the world and it's 90 miles away from China and China claims it as its own country, then for America, that actually represents a strategic threat because a lot of military equipment would be fabricated with chips that are made in those facilities. So America, as a defensive strategy, not just as part of a trade war, but actually to preserve its lines of supply, needs to bring that capacity into the United States. And the Chinese have to be very well aware that this game for global domination in the 21st century is being fought with resources that it claims to own, but it actually doesn't control. And TSMC this week announced they were going to stop manufacturing chips for the Chinese firm Huawei, which is in a huge trade dispute with the United States of America right now. So in some ways, what's happened is that Taiwan is saying our economic interests are far more aligned with the United States and with those chip makers than with China, the nation that it thinks owns us.
Yeah, you don't really want to be in the middle of China and the USA. Who's going to win this?
This is a really good question. I mean, China is working very hard at building its own semiconductor manufacturing capacity, but they're even two generations behind where the other firms are, Samsung and Intel are, which are then two generations behind where TSMC is. So you're talking about four generations. That's probably close to a decade's worth of development before China starts to even draw even where TSMC is today. And TSMC in a decade's time will probably be another 10 years ahead. So is there any way that China can have a comfortable lead without basically taking Taiwan? And that's going to be a question we're going to see played out over the next 10 years. And that's why this move to Arizona is so important.
Mike, just before I let you go, getting such interesting feedback on the COVID app. Varied. I thought you'd be interested in this. So John's texted to say, I'm a tech enthusiast, but the government app is a dud. I installed it but will not use it. It's too cumbersome. GPS should be doing the work. On Wednesday, I visited seven businesses and not one had the required QR code. The government had 2 months to develop this and their so-called app could have come out of a high school class. Oh, I think that's a bit tough on high school classes. I think they do a good job. Very disappointed. Texter says, a problem with the app is that it was released before businesses could get their QR codes. So I've been into about six businesses this morning and couldn't find a QR code anywhere and doesn't provide a lot of confidence in the system. And then Penny's been in touch to say, Morena, I'm in my 70s and downloaded the COVID-19 app this morning. It was easy to download and looks really useful, no problem. So there's all these mixed perspectives on this. It was never going to please everybody, I guess.
And it's also going to take time. There's going to be some teething pains. And we also have to keep in mind there's a portion of the population, probably 10 or 15%, who don't own a smartphone, and they can't use this app at all. And we have to remember that, in fact, when we do something that's smartphone-based, we're also excluding some people. And we have to think about how we actually cover their cases as well.
Mark Pesce, thank you very much. Really interesting. That's our tech correspondent, Mark Pesce.